Hosea chapter 2, and we left off last week in verse 13, so we're going to pick up right here, Old Testament book of Hosea, chapter 2, verse 14, and we're going to read through chapter 3, verse 5, and by God's grace, this is the portion that we will look at tonight. It's a big section for me, but let's see how we do. Hosea 2:14. Therefore, behold, I will allure her, bring her into the wilderness, and speak kindly to her. Then I will give her her vineyards from there, and the valley of Achor as a door of hope. And she will sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the days when she came up from the land of Egypt. Okay, now before I go any further, I just want to give you maybe a little touch of a contextual background so that you can have a clue if you're not sure what's happening here. God is making a reference to the nation of Israel, and she's being spoken of as a woman who has left her husband. In other words, Israel as a nation has been pictured as a woman who ran off from her husband and turned to a life of prostitution. And God has told how he was going to bring a severe judgment upon the nation. And this dates back here to about the 8th century B.C. when God was speaking these words to the nation. And he's speaking to the nation saying, you have gone astray. I'm going to bring a judgment against you. But the day will come when I will bring you back to myself. And so we're going to look a little bit more of context in a minute. But that maybe gives you a little bit of a helpful clue on what's happening here. And so in the end of verse 15, God says, she will sing as in the days of her youth, as in the days when she came up from the land of Egypt. Verse 16, and it will come about in that day, declares the Lord, that you will call me Ishi, and you will no longer call me Bali. For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, so that they will be mentioned by their names no more. In that day, I will also make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, the birds of the sky, and the creeping things of the ground. And I will abolish the bow and the sword and war from the land, and I will make them lie down in safety. And I will betroth you to me forever. Yes, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in loving kindness and in compassion. And I will betroth you to me in faithfulness. Then you will know the Lord. And it will come about in that day that I will respond, declares the Lord. I will respond to the heavens, and they will respond to the earth. And the earth will respond to the grain, to the new wine, and to the oil. And they will respond to Jezreel. And I will sow her for myself in the land. I will also have compassion on her who had not obtained compassion. And I will say to those who are not my people, you are my people. And they will say, thou art my God. Then the Lord said to me, again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress. Even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes. And so I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. And then I said to her, you shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. So I will also be toward you. For the sons of Israel will remain for many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, and without ephod or household idols. Afterward, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they will come trembling to the Lord, to his goodness in the last days. Well, we're coming here to a fourth part that we've titled God's Amazing Compassion. Because what we find in the Bible is we find a description of our God that totally goes beyond anything that we see in the human realm. You know, people have their conceptions of God, and you find all kinds of different ideas about who God is. I was reminded of that this morning when I was looking at the paper, and somebody wrote an article, and the title of this article, it's an editorial in the Daily Breeze, that said, myths and fairy tales create distorted views of God. And what this person said is, in a manner of speaking, and I'm quoting here, the religionist and the scientist are both correct. Yes, God created life, and yes, his technique was evolution. Oh, really? Well, I see that God did create, but I see nothing about evolution in the Bible. But this person wants to suggest that God used evolutionary techniques to bring mankind into being. And what he says later on in this editorial, some guy by the name of Tim McKenna, he says that the concept of God for most people is based on myths, fables, and fairy tales. Well, you know what he's talking about? The Bible. He's saying that our understanding of God is based upon something that is a myth. And he says, such tales created by man at a time when they thought the earth was flat, the sea was full of monsters, and if one went too far in one direction, one would fall off the planet, form the basis of credo and dogma of organized religions. And what he wants to suggest is that, you know, we need to basically eliminate, you know, these kinds of dogmas and come up with, you know, our truth ourselves. He said, as if the truth were something so small that it could be contained between the covers of a book. Any book. Well, I want to tell you something. This person does not know God, and they do not understand who God is. But when I look in the Bible, what I find is I find a depth of knowledge that goes beyond the depth of any ocean on this planet. You find a knowledge of God that shows us a God who is rich in mercy and a God who is deep in compassion. And you know what? I'm content to say that God has revealed everything about himself that he wants us to know in the pages of this book. Amen? God has. I have absolutely no doubt about that. And I have no problem with saying that God has spoken, and I'll follow this book. Number one, because God said that's what he's done. Number two, because I find in the Bible something that is worthy of your trust and worthy of my trust. A book that has shown itself to be right point by point, time after time, again and again. And you know what God does? God pinpoints who we are. God says in the Bible, this is who you are. And you know what? He's exactly right. When he describes the human heart, God hits the bullseye dead center. He couldn't have done it better if he was Robin Hood, you know? The guy speaks because God knows who we are. But what we also find in the Bible is we find a knowledge of who God is. And it shows us a compassion and a mercy and a love that is beyond anything in this world. Now, as we see how that works together and what Hosea is telling us, remember that last week and the last couple weeks we saw that Hosea had been commanded to marry a woman. Hosea chapter 1 in verse 1, God tells Hosea chapter 1 verse 2, take a wife for yourself, a wife of harlotry, and have children of harlotry. God told Hosea to go marry a woman, and Hosea was a prophet who lived in the middle of the 8th century B.C. God said, Hosea, go marry this woman, but she's going to turn to prostitution. But have children with her, marry her, and do this. And Hosea obeyed, and they had three children. And eventually what happened is this woman, whose name was Gomer, deserted Hosea and went off into a life of prostitution. And God said that what is going to happen because of your sin, God said, I am going to bring a severe judgment upon you. And remember that what he's talking about is he's using this wife as an illustration of the nation. The wife, Gomer, is a picture of Israel as a nation. And what God says to the nation is, I am going to bring a severe judgment. Look in chapter 2, for example. In verse 2, God says, contend with your mother, meaning the nation. She's not my wife. I'm not her husband. Let her put away her harlotry from her face and her adultery between her breasts, lest I strip her naked. God says, I am going to come to you. Verse 4, he says, I will have no compassion on her children because they are children of harlotry. Verse 5, their mother has played the harlot. Down in verse 13, God says, I will punish her for the days of the Baals. Basically, what God says is, I am going to bring an absolutely severe judgment. And if you recall, the way that judgment came to Israel was by a foreign power that came in and brought captivity. It was the nation of Assyria that came in the year 722 BC. The Assyrian army came in and just absolutely devastated Israel. And then about 200 years later, another nation came by the name of the Babylonians. And the Babylonians came in and did the same thing against the southern kingdom of Judah. What happens here is this, okay? God promised that he was going to bring a devastating invasion and a foreign captivity, and that is what he did. And effectively what happened is that severed the relationship that Israel had with God. It severed the relationship in the same way that you would have a severed relationship if a man or a woman deserted his or her spouse and walked out. and there was a de facto divorce, and it became final. And God said, this is what you've done to me. And God made the deal final, so to speak, when he brought in his captivity. Well, now when we look at what happened in the Old Testament, if you remember that the Assyrians came in 722, the Babylonians in 605, after the Babylonian invasion, there was about a 70-year time period, and then God allowed the Jews to be released from captivity in Babylon. God arranged it providentially so that the Babylonians were conquered, the Persians came in, and the Persians allowed the Jews to be released. And many Jews did start coming back to their homeland. But guess what? When God talks about a day of restoration, like he does in Hosea and in all the prophets, God gives this promise. And God says, one day I'm going to bring you to myself. One day I'm going to restore you. Israel ended up coming back to the land, but really it was never the fulfillment of the restoration that God promised. Israel came back, and yet it was never a fulfillment. But the day is going to come when God is going to bring a total restoration to that nation. It's going to go beyond anything that you and I can even conceive of. Now, what we're going to find in this section that we're looking at, and again, pray that we'll get through it because there's a lot of material, I want to find 8 proofs of God's compassion, 8 evidences or 8 demonstrations of God's compassion and the depth of his compassion. And the first one that we find here is in verse 14. The first demonstration of God's compassion is this, is that he is going to release Israel from a state of shameful captivity. Let me ask you a question. What was the great captivity of Israel in the Old Testament? Where did they spend a captivity? It starts with an E. Egypt. Remember how they went into Egypt, and then you have Moses, Charlton Heston had to come along in the Ten Commandments, and Moses was the one who brought the children of Israel out of their captivity. Well, there was one captivity in the Old Testament under the times of Moses. Moses brought them out, but what God points to is God is pointing to another day that is going to come when there is going to be a second release from captivity. And this is what you see in verse 14. Now remember, the whole context that has preceded this in the first 13 verses is God says, I am going to bring you into captivity. But then in verse 14, he says, therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness. What God says here is that there is going to be a period when God is going to come to the nation, and he says, I am going to allure her. Interesting word right here. The word allure is the word that would be used if you talk about somebody trying to sweet talk a lady. To woo a lady. It could be a woman to a man, but the idea would be some guy coming along and trying to sweet talk a woman. It's actually used in the book of Exodus to say that, to talk about the penalty if some man comes along and tries to seduce. It's the word for seduce, like to try to seduce a young lady into an immoral relationship. It means to woo or to persuade with sweet words. And what God says is that he is going to take this woman that ran off on him and ran off into prostitution, and God says, I'm going to go after her. I'm going to sweet talk her. I'm going to sweet talk her. And what you see is this. Okay, picture this. In human terms, what if you and I were the one and it was our spouse that ran off with anybody they could find? What would you and I do if it was our spouse? Would we stand there with open arms and say, come on, sweetheart, I love you? I don't think we would be so quick to do that. At least in our sinful nature, we certainly wouldn't be. But when you look at the compassion of God, and here's the point. When God looks at the condition of Israel in this present day, God says the day is going to come when I'm going to speak kindly to her. And then he says, I'm going to bring her, look at this, in verse 14, God says, I am going to bring her into the wilderness. Remember what happened when Moses brought the Israelites out of Egypt? Where did they go? The wilderness. God took them out of Egypt and he led them into a barren desert land. And this is the same picture. It's actually a picture of a final day, an end times restoration that has a parallel to the time of the Egyptian captivity. Keep your spot right here. I want to show you. Go back to the book of Deuteronomy. Keep your spot in Hosea, but go back to Deuteronomy chapter 28. That'd be the 5th book of the Bible. And in Deuteronomy chapter 28, you can see that even back in the days of Moses, which was some 600 years before this, that Moses used this same kind of picture. of a second Egyptian captivity. If you look in Deuteronomy 28:64, it says, "The Lord will scatter you among all the peoples from one end of the earth to the other, to the other end of the earth, and there you shall serve other gods, wood and stone, which you or your fathers have not known." He says, "Among these nations you shall find no rest, and there will be no resting place for the sole of your foot." Has that been true of Israel over the past 1900 years? Oh, you bet it has. That nation has had no rest. I mean, they've been persecuted and hounded. And God said, this is what's going to happen. Notice down here in verse 68, God says, "And the Lord will bring you back to Egypt in ships by the way about which I spoke to you. You will never see it again. And there you shall offer yourselves for sale to your enemies as a male and female slaves, but there will be no buyer." God is talking about here in Deuteronomy 28, the time of a second captivity. Moses said there was going to come a day when you have this captivity, but what we're reading about in Hosea is God says, "But I'm going to release you from that captivity as well. And the way I'm going to do it is I'm not going to come to you, and I'm not going to push your face into the dirt because of your ugly sinfulness. I'm going to sweet talk you. I'm going to come to you as a husband to a wife, and I'm going to sweet talk you so that you come to yourself." God says, look at this, verse 14. He says, "I will speak kindly to her," the New American Standard says. The word literally, "I will speak to her heart." Listen, you want to know something? The reason why you and I are in Jesus Christ is this. Not because God beat us to the ground, but because He spoke kindly to you and me. Amen? Our God spoke kindly to us. Paul says in Romans chapter 2, verse 4, he said, "Do you think lightly of the riches of His kindness and forbearance and patience, not knowing that the kindness of God leads you to repentance?" The way that God deals with sinful people is not by coming to them and trying to destroy them, but He wants to bring them to Himself. In John 3:17, it says, "God didn't send His Son into the world to do what? To condemn the world, but that the world should be saved through Him." Listen, there is coming a day of judgment, without question. There is a day of judgment that is going to come. But when Jesus Christ came to this earth, this was God's way of coming to you and me. And Jesus opened His arms up and said, "You want to know how much I love you? Here's how much." God loves us. Hey, you know what? I believe in the wrath of God because the Bible teaches it. There's coming a day of fierce retribution on sinful people who reject Christ. But you know what? Our God is a God who loves sinners. And the Bible says that He wants sinners to be saved. And I'm glad because, you know what? I'm a sinner. You can put me in that class. Paul said, he said, Christ Jesus came into the world to save who? Sinners. And Paul said, among whom I am chief. If I was rewriting that, I'd say, no, Paul, step out of the way. Put me in there. Because that's me. But you know what? This is how our God deals with this. Now, you have to understand this. Put that into the real life context, because Hosea had a real wife. Her name was Gomer. He was a real man, and his wife ran off. And you see, this is what the picture that God is using. God says, this is what it's like when I deal with you people, Israel. And you know what? The same principle holds true for you and me today, just because we're not the corporate nation of Israel. This is the compassion of God. And I think that it's not going to be until the day that you and I see Him face to face that we really realize how great that compassion is and how deep that mercy is. But I can tell you this. I will promise you this. The day that you stand before Jesus Christ, if that should be at your death or, God willing, the coming of Jesus Christ before that, I can tell you this. When you stand before Jesus and you see Him in His holiness and in His glory, you and I are going to realize just what God saved us from, how sinful we are, we were, and how holy He is. We're going to fall at our feet. We're going to fall at our feet before Him and say, "Jesus, I love You. Thank You for loving me." You see, this is the depth of God's compassion. Now, there's a second way that we see God's compassion, and it's in verse 15. It's a reminder of Israel's future. God, first of all, He brings Israel out of captivity. He brings her out of release from captivity, and then we see a reminder of a future hope. have to realize that when Israel came into this captivity, that most Jews basically said, that's it, man, it's all over. You know, our nation has been decimated, our children have been murdered, our pregnant wives have been ripped open, our people have been destroyed, our cities have been burned. And they looked at all the promises. Now, they had a lot of promises in the Scriptures. God said, I'm going to send a king to you one day who will rule, who will have dominion. God said, I'm going to send you Messiah, and He's going to exalt you and lift you up. And God said, I'm going to bring a restoration to you. And when the captivity came, Israel was basically left without hope. Well, look what God says down here. God gives them a reminder that there is a hope. And He says in verse 15, I will give her her vineyards from there. In other words, God says, I'm going to bring you out of captivity. And right now, so to speak, you could say that all of these Jews who are throughout the world, Israel is still sitting in this state of captivity, this picture of captivity. God says, I'm going to bring you out of captivity into a place where I'm going to restore you. And He says, then, He says, I will give you back your vineyards. Look back at verse 12, chapter 2. God said, here's what's going to happen because of your sin. I'll destroy your vines and your fig trees. And that happened when the Assyrian army came in. God wiped them out. So God is giving a word of hope. He says, I will give her her vineyards. Number 2, God says, I will give her the valley of Achor as a door of hope. And you say, what in the world is He talking about? You remember when Israel came out of Egypt, and they ended up having to spend 40 years in the wilderness wanderings because they didn't believe God when God said He would give them the promised land. And so God said, you don't believe me that I'm going to give you the promised land? Fine, I'll let you wander in the desert until every person who is over 20 years of age dies. Then I will take the next generation, and I will give them the promised land. And that's what you see in the book of Joshua. Joshua is an older man. And God says, okay, Joshua, you are the one who's going to lead Israel into the promised land. What was the first city that they conquered? Come on, Bible scholars. Jericho. Jericho was the first city that fell. The walls came tumbling down. And God said, in Jericho, you don't take anything. You don't take silver, gold, clothing. There's a ban on Jericho. You don't touch anything in the city. You burn the entire thing. So Israel destroyed Jericho. And then they came to the next city, just a few miles east, west from there, a city called Ai. And God said, they went out to battle and they figured, hey, God's for us. And they went out and guess what happened at Ai? Got their tails whipped. And they went and they scattered and they said, oh no! God has deserted us! He's brought us here, but He's deserted us because we've been defeated before the enemy. And what happened is they realized that God had deserted them. And they said, it must be sin. There must be sin. And what they did is they began casting lots to find out who it was among the millions of people, probably 1.5 million or more. They began casting lots, and finally they chose the tribes, and then the family, the clan, and the family. And it came down, and out of all of these lots, it settled on a guy by the name of Achan. And they said, okay, Achan, what'd you do? He says, I took some stuff. And he says, I hid it under my tent. And indeed, what happened is Achan had taken some gold and clothing, and he hid them and buried them in his tent. And guess what? They stoned Achan for that sin, and they put him to death, him and his family, for being in on this whole thing. Guy got put to death for disobeying God. Now, the place where he got stoned was called the Valley of Achor, because it was the place where all hope was lost. Devastated. Israel was devastated. What God says, I'm going to take your devastating loss, your place where you have no hope, I will give you the Valley of Achor as what? A door of hope. God says, I'm going to take your defeat. I'm going to turn it into a place of hope. And he says, as a result of that, Israel, she will sing as in the days of her youth. The youth is pictured when Israel came out of the Egyptian captivity. And the picture of Israel as a young bride, as a young maiden, following trustfully her Lord. And God says, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to turn things around for you, and the day is going to come when you will trust me again, and you will sing. So number one, you see what we're seeing here is God's compassion to take Israel and to restore them. Number one, God says, I'm going to release you from captivity. I'm going to give you a reminder of a future hope. Number three, in verses 16 and 17, God says, I am going to remove all of your oppressing lords. Number three, I'm going to remove your oppressing lords. Verse 16. God says, it will come about that in that day, declares the Lord, that you will call me Ishi. Now, first of all, when is this going to take place? God says it is in what? That day. You say, what day, Pastor? Well, you know what? That expression, in that day, you find it all over the prophetic books of the Old Testament. And most of the time, and I wouldn't say all the time, but most of the time, when you see that expression, in that day, it is pointing to something eschatological, something that has to do with the end times. And Hosea does this a number of times, even in this passage here, is talking about the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord, when God, when Christ comes back to this earth, and when God brings judgment upon sin and brings a restoration to His people. And so this expression here, it points to something end times. Incidentally, if you look in the book of Zechariah, that term is used, or that expression is used 22 times in the book of Zechariah, only 14 chapters. And it's used 19 times in chapters 12, 13, and 14. 19 of its 22 uses in those three chapters, because Zechariah is focusing in on the events of that final seven-year time period, what we call the tribulation. And what God says is, you go to that end times period when I bring judgment upon sin and I bring restoration to my people. God says, in that day, He says, you will call me Ishi. He says, you will not call me Bali. Now, in the Hebrew language, there are several ways that you can use the term, or that you can call someone a husband. One of the names is Baal. Baal. Now, you've heard of the Baals, like Baal worship. Okay, that same word, Baal, it means Lord or Master, one who has rulership and authority. And in the Old Testament, there are passages where the Bible uses this term Baal or Baal to talk about a husband. It's a term that can mean, you mean husband, but it usually has the idea of rulership and harshness. But then there's another word, it's the word Ish. Ish. And it doesn't mean really husband or lord, but it means man. It'd be like some woman say, he's my man. He's my man. You see, very, very sweet and tender. And God says, you're not going to call me Bali, my master. God says, you're going to call me Ishi. You're going to call me my man. You see, there's going to be an intimacy in this relationship that doesn't exist right now. God says, I'm going to take you and I'm going to remove all of the oppressing masters that you have right now, namely the idols that you worship. Now remember, Israel, the big sin that Israel fell into, one of the big sin, idolatry, consisted of Baal worship. And God says, I'm going to take that name Baal that you worship. I'm going to remove the names of the Baals. You're not going to remember the name Baal ever again when I bring you to myself. You won't call me Bali. You'll call me Ishi. My man. My man. You see, this is going to be a compassion that God shows to Israel like has never, ever been seen before. We see in verse 18 a fourth demonstration of God's compassion, and it's this. A repeal of Israel's enmity. You know the word enmity. It means hostility and anger and in conflict. The day is going to come when God removes all of the hostility that Israel is subject to. Notice what He says down here in verse 18. He says, in that day, I will make a covenant for them, meaning the Jews. I will make a covenant for them. Now, covenants are used for different reasons. Sometimes it might be between nations, one covenant with a nation making a covenant with another nation. God made a covenant with Abraham and said, Abraham, I swear that I will give you the land that I promised you. I swear that I will give you blessings. And God made a unilateral contract with Abraham to give him certain blessings. God made a covenant with the nation of Israel through Moses. And that was what we call the Mosaic Covenant, the Mosaic Law. And that happened when Moses brought the Israelites out of the Egyptian captivity. And God gave them a contract and said, here's the rules that you must live by. But the covenant that's being spoken of here is being used in a different sense. And the Bible uses it that way in other passages. He's talking about a protective kind of status. It'd be like if I was, you know, a mobster. And if I came to you and I says, hey, I'll tell you what, you know, I'll make a deal with you, you pay me some money, and I'll give you protection, you know? Yeah, that's it, a covenant, you know? I have a friend, This guy was in Vegas. He had a business. And he got into cash problems trying to get this business, a big construction business, going. And his CPA recommended that he borrow some money until they do a stock deal. And he borrowed money from a guy named Gooley. Believe me, it wasn't a good deal. Ended up being a bad deal. I mean, this was first case first class loan shark. But this is the idea. God says, I'm going to make a covenant for you. But what the covenant is going to do is going to give you protection from all hostility. Notice what he says. I will make a covenant for them, look, with the beasts of the field, the birds of the sky, and the creeping things of the ground. The idea is, God says, I'm going to remove all of the hostility that exists between the animal realm and the human realm. A removal of all hostility from the animal realm against the human realm. Keep your spot here in Hosea, but go back a couple of books to Isaiah. Go back about five books to Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah chapter 11, and I'll show you that I'm not just making this up. This is genuine biblical theology. Isaiah chapter 11. In chapter 11 is dealing with the coming of Christ at His second coming. Verses 1 to 5 describe Christ in his reign of righteousness on this earth, a worldwide kingdom. Notice what the results are of Christ when He comes to this earth. Verse 6, and the wolf will dwell with the lamb. I'll tell you what, you don't see that too often, do you? Verse 6, the leopard will lie down with the kid, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little boy will lead them. Guess what? Little kids will be walking leopards around and wolves around. Notice verse 7, also the cow and the bear will graze, their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. Look at verse 8, and the nursing child will play by the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child will put his hand in the viper's den. They will not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, my kingdom. Why? For the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. God's going to take away the conflict and the hostility that exists between the man, the human, and the animal realm. And a little child will be able to go up and tickle a little cobra. Hey, little cobra. Cobra won't hurt. Why? Because God is basically going to remove the curse from this earth when Jesus Christ returns. Oh, it's going to be an amazing day. This earth is going to be transformed like you and I cannot even imagine. For the millennial kingdom, a period of 1,000 years on this very earth, this is what it's going to be like. But it's not only going to be a removal of conflict from the animal to the human realm, but it's also going to be a removal of conflict between men to men, because he says, I will make a covenant for them, he says, with the animals. Also, he says, I will abolish the bow and the sword and war from the land. I will make them to lie down in safety. God says, I'm going to remove warfare from you, and it will not be here anymore. In the book of Micah, which comes a few books later, in Micah chapter 4, verse 3, God says that He will judge between many peoples. Micah 4, 3. It says Christ will render decisions for mighty distant nations. Listen to this picture. You've probably heard this expression before. Then they will hammer their swords into plowshares. They're going to take their warfare, their weapons of warfare, the F-15s and the F-16s and the tanks. God says they're going to hammer their swords into plows. Why? Because conflict and warfare will be gone. God says nation will not lift up sword against nation. Never again will they train for war. And each of them will sit under his vine and his fig tree with no one to make them afraid. So it's going to be like this. I'll say, hey, would you like to come on over to my house? I've got a fig tree here and a vine. Got some grapes and we can just sit down. Hey, we don't have to worry about somebody bombing us or coming into our school and killing our kids. Why? Because God is going to remove this. And this is God's promise to the nation of Israel. It's a removal of the enmity. All right, we come to verses 19 and 20. This is all looking at God's work with His people. And we see a fifth demonstration of God's compassion. God will give a renewal of Israel's relationship. Verses 19 and 20, God says, I will betroth you to me forever. Now remember, in the Old Testament days, Israel had a relationship with God, and basically as that of a wife to her husband. That relationship got severed because of her sin, her idolatry. And by the way, it wasn't God who initiated a divorce. Israel walked out on the deal. Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 to 34, God said, I was a husband, but you walked out on me. But what God says is the day is going to come when I'm going to bring you back to myself. Now, in the Old Testament days, they have what was called betrothal, and it's, in a certain way, it's kind of like engagement, but it's different. Because in betrothal, what would happen is that you were technically, you were considered to be married. That's why, remember when Joseph and Mary were betrothed together, and Joseph found out that Mary was with child? Okay, and under the law of Moses, Joseph had the right, assuming she had been guilty of unfaithfulness, Joseph had the right under the law of Moses to do what? Put her to death. He had the right. But it says because Joseph was a righteous man and he didn't want to disgrace her and he didn't want to hurt her, he cared for her, he was just going to quietly divorce her because he thought, hey, she's been unfaithful to me. Well, you see, betrothal involved a marriage relationship, but the only thing that did not come in the betrothal period was that of consummation of the relationship. There was no cohabitation. There was no intimate relationship between the betrothed parties. Now, Israel has departed from God and has left God, but what God says is, I'm going to come back to you again. I'm going to bring you to myself. We're going to get engaged again. And he tells us the way that he does it. There's going to be a difference because God is going to transcend that old relationship so that never again will Israel do what she did before. He says, I will betroth you to me, first of all, he says, forever. It's going to be an eternal relationship. Now, as far as the Old Testament went, Israel could have had an eternal relationship with God if they had never walked away. In God's sovereignty and knowing all things, the end from the beginning, God knew what they would do. And, Christ had to come and Christ had to die for sin and all of these other things had happened. But as far as His promise was to Israel, Israel could have remained in that relationship forever. Okay? But what God says is, the day is going to come when I will betroth you to me. And He says, this time it will be forever. Number two, God says, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice. And this refers to a standard that is upright and honest. In other words, a fair relationship. You know, you've heard me talk about my dad, you know, that he got married here last November, found a woman, fell head over heels, and, you know, opened his heart to her, and then she walked out on him. And she walked out. Now she's, trying to take his money. And my dad opened his heart to this woman. And she claimed to be a Christian. My dad thought that he was, entering a relationship based upon Jesus Christ. And she dumped him and walked out. My dad got dumped on. You know what? And it makes everybody in the family angry. My sister says, if I see that woman on the streets, I'm going to give her a piece of my mind. My grandma will too. But that's beside the point. Okay, but what God says is, God says, when I bring you back to myself, He says, I'm going to betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice. You're not going to do this to me again. You will not do this to me again. And then He uses a third expression. He says, I will betroth you to me, He says, in loving kindness and in compassion. This speaks about the tenderness, the loving kindness term. It's that real, real rich Hebrew word, hesed. The hesed, which means covenant loyalty, loyal faithfulness, a steadfast, enduring love. This is what characterizes God's relationship to His people. It's His hesed, His covenant faithfulness. And God says, when I bring you to myself, the basis of it is going to be covenant faithfulness, loyalty. He says, it will be in compassion. The word that talks about tender mercies. Even the same word, rechem, that talks about the womb of a woman where the baby forms in the rechem. God says, I'm going to betroth you to me in rachamim, in tender compassions. So it's going to be a close relationship. God says, I'm going to bring you to myself in a way that you will never before have experienced. And He says, that I'm going to betroth you to me, last of all, He says, in faithfulness. You're not going to walk off of me. You're not going to run off. He says, it's going to be there forever, you and me together. One commentator, Charles Feinberg, tremendous Jewish scholar, tremendous Hebrew scholar. He was at Talbot Seminary, and has a book that he's written on Hosea and some of the other prophets. Charles Feinberg says, Israel is no longer seen as a harlot or an adulteress, but, mind you, as an unsullied virgin. She is seen as though she had never sinned. Think about that. As though she had never sinned. Now, you and I, put that into the human plane that you and I live in. Let's suppose that it was your wife or your husband who just ran off dozens of men or women. Would you and I go after someone like that and open our hearts up and say, I'm going to sweet talk you until you just melt in my arms? This is what our God has done for us, and this is what our God is going to do for the covenant nation of Israel. You see, because what we see in the pages of Scripture, this is my point when I open the message, is people who don't know God, they have no clue of the compassion of God. You see, they will mock Christians and they will mock the Bible and say, ah, what kind of a God is this that would let a bunch of school kids get murdered on a playground? What kind of a God is that? I suppose God might say, well, you never let me into the school. How could I protect them? Listen. People who don't know our God, they don't understand the compassion of God. What they like to do is they like to mock God and mock the faith. Why? Because they reject the gospel. And they're sitting in their sin and they don't want to give an account to God. And so they mock it. But when you understand the love of our God, you realize that, you know what, there is a depth of compassion here that would save every human being on this planet if every human being would turn to Him in faith. This is our God. This is our God. And look at the result here in verse 21. God says, I will betroth you to me in faithfulness. Then you will know Yahweh, Jehovah, the Lord. You will know the Lord. You know what? Do you know who he's talking about right here? Do you want to know who Israel is going to know, who Israel is going to come to know in that day? I'll tell you his name, Jesus. The day is going to come when God brings Israel back to himself. Israel, as a nation, is going to realize that Jesus of Nazareth is God's Messiah. And that is going to be the one whom they bow to, and their knees will confess that Jesus Christ is what? Lord. Same word right here. Lord. Jehovah. Yahweh. Jesus said, they will confess, and they will bow to me, and they will confess that I am Lord. This is God's plan. Well, let's see. Boy, I tell you what, we definitely aren't going to finish chapter 3. But let's go ahead and press on here. Let's look over here at verses 21 and 22, and we see a sixth demonstration of God's compassion to the nation of Israel. It's going to be a response of material blessings to the people. You have to understand that Israel had a unique relationship with God. In that relationship, what God said, under the law of Moses, God said, if you will obey, I'm going to pour it on you. Go back to Deuteronomy for a minute. Go back to Deuteronomy chapter 27, and I want to show you how the Mosaic Law worked. Remember, that was a covenant. God made a covenant with the nation. They call these covenants a suzerain vassal treaty. That's describing the kind of contract that a king would make if he conquered a foreign power. And this is the same kind of form that you find in the book of Moses, in the book of Deuteronomy. It's like a contract where God is the king and God says, I'm the king, now you have to obey me. Okay, now follow what happens. I said 27, but look at chapter 28. God says in Deuteronomy 28, it shall be that if you will diligently obey the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments, which I commanded you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you if you will obey the Lord your God. Deuteronomy 28:1. The covenant of Moses, the law of Moses said, obey God, and God is just going to pour the blessings upon the nation. And when they did turn to God in faithfulness, that's exactly what happened. But God also said, if you turn away from me, it's going to be hard times. You know, you're going to have deficit spending. Other nations are going to become powerful. You're going to become weak. You're going to become the tail. The other people are going to become the head. Look at chapter 28, verse 15. If you will not obey the Lord your God to observe all his commandments and his statutes, which I charge you today, then all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. Cursed in the city, cursed in the country, cursed in your basket, cursed in your kneading bowl. And God goes down for about the next 50 verses and says, cursed, 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 cursed. Okay, now here's where Israel has come to. Israel has basically turned away from God, and they've lost everything. The land is not producing anything. There's no rains. There's famines. There's droughts. No food. People are dying. But God says, when I restore you to myself, there's going to be a response come from the heavens and from the earth, and I'm going to cause the blessings to flow to you again. And that's what verse 20 says, verse 21. God says, it will come about when? In that day, that I will respond. First of all, there's a chain. God says, I will respond. Okay? And God says, I will respond to the heavens. The heavens, they will respond to the earth. The earth will respond to the grain, to the new wine, to the oil. There's going to be something happening. God is going to basically lift the curse from the nation of Israel. And so the rains are going to flow from heaven. The earth is going to have the rain. And God says you're going to get grain. You're going to get the new wine. New wine was the fresh, rich grape. Real sweet grapes. Kirosh. The new wine. Rich, rich, sweet wine. The oil here is not just any oil, but it's the word that speaks about the fresh, virgin olive oil. The real, fresh, virgin oils. God says, this is what I'm going to give to you. Why? Look at here in verse 20, 22. They will respond to Jezreel. I said, Jezreel? What's Jezreel? Well, something is going to begin right here in these verses that follow. And God starts referring back to the names of Hosea's children. Jezreel was the name of Hosea's first child. Look back to chapter 1, verse 3. Chapter 1, verse 4. Hosea's first child, the Lord said to him, name him Jezreel. The word Jezreel, actually in Hebrew, it means God sows. Like if you were sowing seeds and you were going out, that's what Jezreel means. It means God sows. But there is a dual use of this name in the book of Hosea. In chapter 1, God is referring to a place of judgment because Jezreel was a town in Israel. And God says, I'm going to bring judgment at Jezreel, chapter 1. But in chapter 2, what he does is he's using Jezreel to talk about God throwing seeds out and God causing a lot of growth. So Jezreel is being used in a different sense. In other words, what's happening is, in chapter 1, God takes the names of Hosea's three children and says judgments and condemnation. But in chapter 2, he says, take those same names and I'm going to bring blessings to my people. And so first of all, he says they're going to respond to Jezreel. In other words, I am going to produce prosperity. Verse 23, he says, I will sow Israel for myself in the land. Now notice this. God says, I will also have compassion on her who had not obtained compassion. Guess who he's talking about right here? Child number 2.